Recently, the theatrical Met Gala made its annual headlines as designers and celebrities took fashion into the high realms of fantasy and creativity. When we think of fashion, we perhaps think of runways and supermodels, haute couture and iconic designers, but certainly something easily dismissed as superficial, perhaps fussy, inaccessible, and dare we even say pretentious. But fashion is so much more than style, more than beauty, and even deeper than simply a look. And like it or not, is highly political. After all, how we clothe ourselves is performative, a way in which we express our identity in our day-to-day lives. Like it or not, and it must be said, accurately or not, our fashion can convey gender, class, ethnicity, religious identity, even our politics. But also consider this. What's considered popularly stylish or fashionable can also reinforce and play into roles, stereotypes, and power structures that we might rather subvert. As much as what maybe we consider unfashionable, or at least could be considered unfashionable by one, could certainly incur judgment, dismissal, and scorn upon others. But it's also an industry, a big one. And despite a slight dip in 2016, it is still a $3 trillion with a T, trillion dollar one at that, comprising 2% of the global GDP. To put that astronomical number in context, listen to this. The global fashion industry is larger than the GDP of the UK and nearly twice the size of Canada's entire economic output. If fashion and the garment industry were to be its own country, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world. The combined fashion and textile industry employs nearly 4 million people around the world, and the industry as a whole spends around $500 billion with a B annually on advertising. And look, the advertising portion alone of that could be its own show, with narratives swirling around about the use of Photoshop and beauty standards and body image and body positivity and mental health, especially in this time of rapid social change and increased awareness. But tonight, we'll take a look at many aspects of the fashion industry, economic, sociological, labor, and human rights issues, themes of politics and identity, and even the influence moments in history have had on fashion and that fashion has had on history. That's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special on WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us this evening. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your time with us. So tonight we're talking about fashion and the garment industry. And as any topic we ever pick here on the Saturday Night Special, it seems like something that's very, very straightforward. But as we start to dig into it a little bit and unbox it a bit, it is very nuanced and there's many, many different facets to it. And this topic is no exception. And so we're joined now by Dr. Kimberly Chrisman Campbell, who is an art historian specializing in fashion and textiles. She's worked as a curator, consultant, and educator for museums and universities around the world and is a frequent contributor to books, scholarly journals, and magazines. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Amy. Thank you for having me.
So to start, I would like to really take a look at, as we're talking about kind of the history of fashion, what is the academic study of fashion?
Well, the history of fashion is something that's been looked at by art historians for a long time as a way to date their paintings. You can date a work of art very narrowly if you know something about the dress that you're looking at. So it's my field began as a subset of art history, but it quickly developed into its own field in the early 20th century and is now taught in a variety of different academic contexts, whether museum studies, gender history, design history, or anthropology even. I mean, I know anthropologists who work on textile history, and they're looking at really just scraps of fabric that have been dug out of bogs and tombs and things like that. And to me, it seems so foreign to what I do, yet we are all part of the same wonderful field.
When we think about fashion, I think it seems like there's the very practical, and then there's it's all about excess. I'm thinking of courtly attire, and it was really all about showing money and wealth and really just showing showiness, really. And then on the other side of that, you had kind of the have not. You had people that were probably doing agricultural work and they were dressing very practically, things like that. And we see that kind of duplicated around the world. When did we really first start seeing fashion as its own kind of thing that was about show and it was about identity and it was a bit performative?
Well, the idea of fashion as identity is somewhat new, I'd say, within the past 200 years or so. I mean, in the 18th century, fashion was very controlled. It was actually something that was regulated by laws and by courts and by kings, and the industry was subsidized by ruling parties. And the idea of fashion as a personal expression is sort of a modern one, although it's one we definitely use as we look at dresses past of all periods. But there's been fashion as long as there's been clothing, pretty much. We tend to think of it as something very beautiful and expensive and elaborate and performative, largely because that's what survives. Everyday dress, the dress of working people, of poor people, doesn't really make it into museums or even imagery like fashion plates or portraits. So it's much harder to get to grips with as a scholar.
And when you look at knowing all that you know about history and fashion and looking at now where it seems like fashion moves very quickly, it seems a lot more disposable, identity, you know, extends out through social media, things like that. What do you see mirrored? Mm-hmm. What are we mirroring back at, or what maybe does this time remind you of another period of history?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, as a historian, because I've looked at fashion throughout history, very little surprises me. I mean, it always is like there's nothing new. It's all been done before. It's all been worn before. And that's partly because the reasons we wear clothes have not changed. I mean, we really don't wear clothes for warmth or protection. That's obviously part of it. But even in cases where we look, you know, in the very, very distant past, we think, well, all they cared about was survival. No, there was always individuality. There was always fashion involved in some form. There was always change. And so the things that drive fashion, which are, you know, human frailty and vanity and ingenuity, are always going to be the same, no matter which time period you're looking at.
Hmm. You mentioned a little bit earlier when you're looking at fashion and history, you mentioned gender. And where do you really, you know, I think immediately of how, like, the Victorian notion of public spheres and private spheres for men and women, mm-hmm. and that kind of division. How do you see that playing out in fashion? I can't help but draw some parallels to, like, body policing and modesty narratives that are still very much part of the conversation now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, women definitely get the brunt of criticism about fashion. And you know, I kind of get frustrated when people say, oh, well, it's just a dress. It's never just a dress. It's always more than that. It means more than that. But we have to remember, too, this is a fairly recent thing, because up until a couple of centuries ago, right after the French Revolution, again, things like lace and embroidery and sequins and ribbons and muffs and wigs and makeup, those were unisex ornaments. So that was a sign of wealth and taste rather than gender. So it's really only the past 200 years that men have become less ornamental, less decorative. We tend to think of women as being, you know, really into shoes and really into fashion and color, and men wear suits and they tend to be a little more dressed down. And that narrative is always going to be a challenge. There's always going to be the dandy and the fashionable man, you know, the metrosexual. But in general, we tend to divide the sexes into sort of the more fashion conscious, the more decorative women, and the more practical and less interesting men.
And why did that decline occur for men?
It was largely because of the French Revolution and the subsequent years following the Revolution, when men were supposed to be more business oriented. They were supposed, we talk about in the 19th century, the great masculine renunciation. That's a historical phrase coined at the time to describe the idea of men wearing black, men wearing suits, men being very buttoned down. I mean, literally, while women were the vehicle by which a family would show off its wealth and taste. But again, this is a fairly recent phenomenon if you're looking at the entire history of fashion, where men have always played a very active and important role in fashion, and in many cases been more decorative than women, depending on the time period and culture.
And so what sort of political implications has fashion had in other parts of the past? You know, you mentioned the French Revolution, and where did we see big shifts for fashion along with major historical events?
Yeah, fashion is incredibly political and always has been. And again, I sort of get frustrated when people say, oh, well, you know, I like fashion because it's an escape from these challenging times and from political dissent. And it's never an escape. It has a lot to say about politics. And it is a very effective way of communicating political meaning because it's literally in your face. I mean, it's very visible. You don't have to be able to speak or write or have a voice in society to wear something that has political meaning. And this was very important in the years before the French Revolution, when women in particular were expressing their political thoughts and allegiances through fashion, even though they didn't really have a part in government or the military or any of those sort of traditional avenues. But if you look back at the history of fashion, most of the major dramatic changes in fashions have come about not because of changes in taste or technology, but because of wars, because of conflict, and because of political dissent, the Victor Wright history, the Victor Wright fashion history, when France began to eclipse Spain in the 16th century as the sort of leading political force in Europe. Suddenly, nobody wanted to wear Spanish fashions anymore. Everybody was buying them in France.
That's a very interesting example. Can you think of other times when we saw a shift like that, that really had a lot to do with like political identity or maybe, allegiance to another culture or something like that?
Well, World War II, another example of a time when fashion became very politicized, and just the very idea of dressing up and, you know, using the resources that were required to produce and wear fashions was very controversial. So that was a major shift in fashion. You know, we talk about Dior's new look, and the reason why it was so new was because it came after a time of great restraint in fashion, where there were, in Europe especially, laws stating how much fabric you could use in a skirt and how many pockets you could have because so many resources were being devoted to the war effort.
How interesting. Pockets, I think, just pockets alone are so political, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I was recently at an event and there was a woman there in this very interesting dress. Turns out she sewed it herself. And all these women were coming up to her because they realized she had a hand in a pocket. And people were going, oh my gosh, where did you find this dress with a pocket? And it became such a big deal. And it was really about, you know, it's about what you can carry. It's about self-sufficiency. I mean, pockets are about a lot more than just a place to rest your hand. They're a big deal.
Yes, I worked on a museum show where we had a male and a female mannequin. And it was from around the turn of the century, maybe the early 1900s, 1910. And the man's suit had something like 18 pockets in it. When you counted up, you know, the pants and the vest and the inside pockets and the outside pockets. And the women's dress had none. It had, wow, I think, 30 pairs of hooks and eyes.
Right. All in the back.
But that's just such a perfect expression of the, you know, the gender roles at the time.
Right, right. That is so interesting. And you know, I've read, you know, every once in a while this kind of narrative pops up a little bit about the corset and how we've been so liberated. But then we look at things like Spanx and control top pantyhose, right, and things like that. And I'm not so sure we are that liberated.
No, and we, you know, today we work out at the gym every day to achieve the body that the underwear used to impose on us. So the vanity has not gone away at all. And the idea of a specific body type that you had to be fashionable has not gone away at all. It's just changed.
Right. In a piece that you wrote for The Atlantic, I will, for those who follow me on Twitter, I will be sure and tweet this out after the program. The headline is My Life as a Fashion Historian and Costume Curator. It is such an interesting piece. In particular, I was really struck by the commentary around mannequins, because I think that's kind of something, you know, people sometimes make fun of mannequins, or they criticize maybe an unrealistic body standard. But you take it into such a deeper level in your conversation about mannequins. And I wonder if you could share a bit of that with listeners.
Oh, gosh. We talk about mannequins all the time in costume museums. They're sort of the bane of our existence, but they're also so important to our work that we really have to think very carefully about them. A museum mannequin, the standard museum mannequin that most museums aspire to use, if they can afford it, is a $3,000 Kyoto mannequin, which is wonderful because it's very versatile, it's adjustable, because of course we are putting clothes on them that were not made in standard sizes in most cases. They were custom made for imperfect bodies, and yet we have to make them fit these fairly mass produced, you know, standard size mannequins. And the way we do that is by doing a lot of padding, doing some amputation sometimes when necessary. And unfortunately, one of the side effects of this is that you really end up showing small clothes. And of course, you know, everyone thinks everybody was smaller in the past. That's not true. You know, George Washington was taller than George Bush. There have always been very large people around, and many of their clothes do survive. They don't survive as much as small clothes because fabric was so expensive in the pre-industrial age that it was often cut down and reused. And if you had a big dress, it was very easier to make a small dress out of it. Whereas if you were a small man or a small woman, it was harder to reuse your clothes to make something new out of. So what survives in museums tends to be small, but even when we do have an outfit made for a larger person, it's very hard to display them because the mannequins are small and you can only put so much padding on them before you end up with sort of a pinhead on this giant body. So mannequins somewhat determine what can be displayed in museums. And then, of course, once you have a mannequin, you have to decide, does it have a head? Does it have a face? Does it have hair? Does it have hands? There are all these questions that go along with mannequins. Skin color as well. I mean, often museum mannequins are white because it's thought to be a neutral color, but it also conveys Caucasian. And we really want to not get that impression, especially if you're doing a show where you're showing clothes from different races, different cultures, different designers. We want, you know, the mannequins to reflect a society that wore these clothes, and often that doesn't happen, unfortunately.
That's so interesting. I'm thinking in particular of the time I visited here in Illinois, the Abraham Lincoln Museum down in Springfield, and there's a room of Mary Todd Lincoln's dresses, and they're very beautiful, and you can, you know, sit there and look at all of these amazing little details, and they're so gorgeous, but they don't have heads. They're just a bodice, you know, they're just like a body form. And I was standing there looking at them, and another, you know, another person came into the room, and she had a child with her, and she was like, they don't have heads. And she was like very alarmed by that. But then this woman and her daughter got into this conversation about, well, if she had a head, it would need to look just like Mary Todd Lincoln. And then we'd have a bunch of Mary Todd Lincolns, and then it might be weird to have like a room full of Mary Todd Lincolns.
Sure. And you don't want to a really realistic head that gives the impression of a wax museum. I mean, often the hair is made of paper or fabric or, you know, something that doesn't look like hair. So it's a very tricky thing, and it's very hard to get it right.
Right, because if you know, I'm thinking of like the mannequins in the 80s that were in department stores, and they were just so ridiculous and creepy looking, and really didn't do the job right. And as you said, you know, so many even storefronts go to like a more streamlined, like faceless, just kind of form for their clothing that conveys, really just makes you want to look at the clothes more than the form of the person behind them, which I think is so very interesting. There's a line in this piece in The Atlantic that I have to read. It is so funny. It is a part where people ask you, but what is it you do? What do you actually do? And the answer, this line is so good. But what do you actually do is a question I get all the time. And a full answer involves mannequin mutilation and crotch stuffing, writing and lecturing, bidding on eBay, researching history and art history, and honing a sense of style that both channels and transcends the sensibilities of any given era. That is such a wonderful, sounds like a very wonderful career.
There's never a dull moment, and it is different every day. I mean, it's hard to answer that question because today you could be on the floor, under somebody's skirt, sort of creating a giant petticoat under a Victorian dress, and then the next day you're lecturing or in the library. It changes every day, and that's wonderful. I really enjoy that part of it.
And how does, because you know historic clothing so intimately, how does that shape your view of maybe more mass-produced modern clothing?
Yeah, well, I talk about this with my colleagues a lot too, because we're not all wearing things right out of the pages of Vogue. Even if we would like to, we can't afford to. But we do have very specific ideas about clothing, and one of the things that I've found is sort of common in my field is we really love natural fibers. Really great 100% linen garments or beautiful silks, not the polyesters and the rayons and things like that. And that's hard because that's hard to find these days. There are some wonderful high-tech fabrics out there, but there's nothing like, a really beautifully made, natural fiber. And we handle those all the time. So we really appreciate that and that sort of handcrafting. We are very good about taking care of our clothing because we know it needs to stay out of the light. It needs to be, packed in acid-free tissue paper if it's being stored. We have a lot of great tricks for keeping clothing looking good for a long time. And me personally, I don't wear vintage for a couple of reasons. Partly because there's an ethical concern, but also because it's just hard to find good vintage that fits well and doesn't smell funny. And the phrase I use is I can't believe it's not vintage. I love things that have sort of a vintage look to them that are made today and are new garments.
Would you say more about that? But what are the ethical concerns that you have around vintage clothing?
Well, if you are working in a museum that has a Clara McCardle in its collection and you're wearing a Clara McCardle dress, that's automatically a conflict of interest right there. And this is a subject that's kind of under debate in the museum field, but many of us feel like if it should be in a museum, that's what it should be. It shouldn't be in your closet. And also the idea that, we know how valuable these things are and how important they are. We don't want to wear them and wear them out and possibly damage them. We want to take good care of them.
Right. You're looking as more of an exhibition than a thing to hang in the closet and wear.
Right. It's a work of art.
Right. And so where do you see, with the wonderful perspective that you have on the fashion industry, what concerns you about where we're heading, or what excites you, or maybe a little of both, about when you kind of look forward of what the garment industry is doing now, where does your mind go?
Well, two places. I am very concerned, actually, that the American garment manufacturing industry is practically non-existent these days. As recently as the late 60s, 95% of American designers actually made their clothes in the U.S., and that's not the case anymore. It's actually more like 5% do, and the rest of it is outsourced, which is a shame for a lot of reasons. I mean, I'm not particularly invested in the idea that made in the USA is better, because there are a lot of great places that are making wonderful fashions. But I think there are a lot of ethical concerns when we're looking at the third world factories that are making garments, first of all. And there's also a lot of wonderful knowledge and just equipment and experience that's been lost in the U.S. And I would really like to see that come back, because we did have such a robust garment and textile manufacturing industry that we're losing every day. Many designers are trying to get back to it, but it's hard, because partly it's extremely expensive if you want to wear something that's made in the USA. And I always tell my students, you know, give them an assignment, go to your closet and see how many things in your closet are actually made in the USA. And it might be nothing. It's going to be very, very little. Even Levi's aren't made in the USA anymore. So that's something that bothers me a lot. But I'm also very excited about the way the fashion industry is thinking about sustainability, mm-hmm. and how we can get away from, you know, fabric wastage, fast fashion. A lot of people have sort of rebelled against and are challenging the idea of how many clothes do we need, and is this really helpful to have really cheap clothes that are maybe not produced very ethically, maybe not very high quality, but we can buy a lot of them because they're cheap. So there is sort of a backlash against that that I think is taking us in a really positive direction. And there have been some wonderful, really creative solutions to this problem of, you know, the environmental and social impact of the fashion industry around the world.
Yeah, there is so much about that, and I think it's very interesting when companies come right out with that part and say, you know, we made this here, or we, you know, fair trade fabric, or any of those kind of conversations. Mm-hmm. I think more and more that's a part of the consumer demand, which is a really, really interesting one. You know, I think that's very interesting what you were saying about the U.S. industry. In particular, I think a lot about that in terms of textiles and kind of craftsmanship. And I know, like, craftsmanship and artisan is a word that kind of gets, like, those are words that get thrown around a lot. But really, if you look at, like, quilts and clothing and things like that were just made so lovingly by hand so many years ago, and now you kind of see, like, oh, look, 50 of this bedspread is at Target, and they're all identical, and they're going to fall apart after 3 washes, and, you know, things like that. I think, and maybe that's a romanticized view, you tell me, but it seems like there, over time, we've maybe lost, not just in the U.S., I think everywhere, maybe, like, manufacturing has lost some quality and detail of fabric, the way we treat fabric, the way we interact with it, and the way we transform it.
Oh, I can tell you that, having worked with historic garments. I mean, 18th century gowns that are handmade from hand-woven silk, made from hand-spun thread, those are going to be around 500 years from now. Everything I'm wearing right now won't be. You know, these man-made textiles and the fast fashions aren't going to stand the test of time, unfortunately.
Yeah. Oh, and that's, you know, in some ways, like, that's why the work that you do, that's why that's so important, right? Because to preserve all of those wonderful things, maybe don't preserve, like, all the t-shirts that, you know, people buy at Target. Maybe not those. We don't necessarily need that in our time capsule of life, but nonetheless, what fascinating work that you do. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Dr. Kimberly Chrisman Campbell, art historian specializing in fashion and textiles. I wish we had hours more to talk about all the fascinating things that you do, but I really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's been a pleasure.
We'll be right back in just a bit to talk more about fashion and the garment industry right here on 720 WGN. With Anya Aronofsky-Kronberg, who is the founder and editor-in-chief of Vestoy, a publication that is all about critical thinking as it's connected to fashion. Anya, thank you so much for joining us from Paris.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as we've, you know, as we've been looking at all this conversation that swirled around the Met Gala in the last week, and you know, there here's this event that's really all about pushing boundaries and fantasy and all of this, And yet, when we talk about fashion so often, this particular event seems to be somewhat the exception, although I think there are some rules still applied to it. But for the most part, when we talk about fashion, we sort of agree culturally that we need to talk about it very critically, and it needs to be critiqued. Because that's sort of the intersection where your magazine sits, I'd like to start there.
Of course. I think what I'm trying to do really with the story is to say that fashion, it's really to present an alternative, I suppose, to your conventional fashion magazine, you know, the one you find on the shelves at your local news agents, the one that is dictated primarily by the advertising on its pages. You know, advertising today influences so much of what gets promoted in the media, and fashion, of course, is no different. So with Vestoy, I am giving or an alternative, or saying, you know, this is what a fashion magazine can also look like, or this is how we can think critically about a topic like fashion that otherwise still so often is thought of as something superficial or flimsy or a sort of, I don't know, woman's business, essentially. So Vestoy draws on sociology, on anthropology, on philosophy, on economics, literature, all these other discourses to look at fashion, and always through, in the journal at least, a particular lens. So this most recent issue, for instance, deals with authenticity. You know, what does it mean to be authentic today? Is there even such a thing as a real self, and how does fashion and fashion marketing play into that?
I think that's a very, very interesting point. And, you know, the sense I have is that so much of the fashion narrative is really, as you said, it's a woman's light topic, and it's kind of fussy and flimsy. But often the criticism attached to fashion is very personal. It's you made the choice to wear this thing that may not be good enough, versus thoughtful criticism thinking about fashion narratives and what's attached to it and what's shaped it and what's attached to it politically and, as you said, sociologically and philosophically and economically. I think those are very interesting distinctions to make.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think so often about how the general culture's attitude towards fashion also affects those of us who work in fashion. It's almost like a lot of us suffer from some sort of inferiority complex. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how many times I've heard people in fashion say things like, well, it's only fashion, we're not saving lives, or, you know, things like that. Almost like a sort of, to make an excuse for working in an industry that even those of us working in it seem to see as superficial, instead of thinking of fashion as part of culture and as such, of course, worthy of the same type of critical discourse as, you know, any other part of human culture or society. But then I think fashion, I mean, it's also, you know, it's an industry that's so easy to point fingers at. It really is, because there are so many unsustainable practices going on in fashion, and it's so very tightly or bound to insecurities or feelings of inadequacy, or you know all those things that need to be, all those feelings that need to be fanned in the consumer to make him or her buy more stuff, you know. And then, and we all know about the unsustainable effects that fashion has on the environment or on human rights, none of us seem to know exactly what to do about it. And so most of us, both consumers and producers of fashion, have this deeply, deeply complex and problematic relation to to the industry. So it, I think that in itself gives rise to this very convoluted relationship that we have to fashion. You know, like on the one hand, it's this multi-billion dollar industry, and at the same time, you know, it's only fashion. That is, it's yeah, it's complex.
Yeah, yeah, right. Not an easily unpacked topic, but you know, I wonder too. We seem, you know, we're moving into a new time, right? I think we've been, I know on this show, we've had many conversations about, you know, the shifting culture, the Me Too movement, things like that. And it's interesting to juxtapose that on top of this moment, to go back to the Met Gala a minute, because, you know, there's a time when excessive fashion is sort of seen as confidence, and I think even in street fashion, we talk about someone being really bold with fashion as being confident and being on top, you know, in a different space than and somehow less susceptible to attacks and criticism from fashion critics. And now we are in this other space where for so long we say, well, fashion's not political; it's just this surface thing. And yet, in this moment we're in, I think we're in a place where we can have deeper conversations and perhaps recognize that in a little bit deeper way, that you know, even in very minute ways, in small ways in our lives, even if it's like a logo with a t-shirt, something like that, there is, you know, and it's kind of like a long way to get to this point, but nonetheless, it seems like we're in this moment where we almost seem a little bit more prepared and almost hungry for this deeper conversation about how very political fashion is and has always been.
Well, I mean, fashion clearly is about identity politics, right? Fashion is about how we want to be perceived in the world. You know, I don't think you can really tell. I mean, this is something I was thinking a lot about when I was dealing with this, with the topic of authenticity. You know, can you really tell someone's quote unquote real self through what he or she wears? Well, I don't think so. But what you can tell is how a person wants to be perceived, right? Fashion is all about the persona that we consciously or unconsciously, you know, project on the world. So, in that sense, you know, fashion. Of course, fashion is about politics in the sense that it's about identity, right? And then, at the same time, on a grander scale. To quote the great philosopher Skunk Anansie, yes, it's political. Everything's political. But yeah, of course, fashion is political in, you know, in the same way that everything that we as human beings produce is political, right? But I think, like, right now you mentioned the Me Too movement, and it's hard to have a conversation really with anything culture-related or anything maybe related to anything at the moment without mentioning Me Too. And fashion, I've noticed, also is trying in various ways to deal with a social consciousness, let's say, or to deal with politics in this very broad kind of vague sense, and to show that, I mean, luxury brands, you know, from Dior, you know, making t-shirts that say feminist on them, to small independent brands questioning beauty norms by introducing a more diverse costing on the catwalk or in campaigns and so on. It's like, it's, of course, it's important for a fashion brand to at least appear to engage with the current discourse. And right now, that discourse is about being quote unquote, you know, woke, as you would say in America. And I think in fashion, or let's say fashion as defined by luxury high fashion brands, that also that also is starting to come through. But at the same time, it's almost like an impossible equation for a big luxury brand, because on the one hand you have to show that you're part of the zeitgeist, that you're dealing with whatever is dealing, let's say, with the political hot topic of the moment, whatever that may be, but at the same time you can't afford to alienate your actual consumers. If, for example, diversity in terms of gender, in terms of race, or in terms of socioeconomic background, let's say, is important in this particular cultural moment, a fashion brand has to be seen to engage with that, but at the same time, how to say this? I don't know how it could be anything other than a kind of surface engagement, because you also have customers all over the world in every market that you have to keep happy, and you have to keep them buying your brand. So, if, for instance, gender diversity is something that is important to millennials in North America, how does that play with a middle-aged consumer in the Middle East or in China, for instance? How do you manage as a high fashion or luxury brand to speak to everybody at the same time? It's impossible. So it also, big corporations today are almost in it's an impossible situation to at the same time show that you're engaged, but also not rock the boat too much, or at all, in fact.
I want to shift a little bit and talk more about your publication, about Vestoy, and the authenticity issue that you have now. And what was surprising to you about creating that issue, or what maybe did you change your thinking on through the production of it?
Well, I think I wouldn't say that I came at it with a very particular with anything in particular that I wanted to show or to prove. I just was really curious about how important authenticity as a value is in fashion marketing, and this. You can see it, of course, in other areas of culture also, but since fashion is my domain, that's what I'm focusing on. I started really paying attention to how often terms like heritage or craftsmanship or skill, things like that, were used in fashion marketing. I started picking up on how big corporations talk about themselves as family, or how offices are called campus, all this rhetoric that's brought in to give a sense of something more intimate rather than this, big corporate world that we live in now, and that fashion is certainly, a huge part of. And I got curious about how consumers look to secondhand or vintage clothes, for example, to appear or feel more authentic. Or I was thinking about how fashion uses social media to because it feels or appears more authentic than your traditional ad campaign, getting a so-called influencer to wear your clothing on Instagram, or to some fashion event and then get photographed. That somehow seems more real than having a traditional model appear in a garment in a campaign, right? Just like all these new ways of communicating in fashion that to me, seem to all tap into this desire for realness or for authenticity. And then I started asking, you know, is it fair to expect authenticity from clothing? You know, is it fair to think that, you know, what does it mean when we say, you know, oh, this, you know, this dress, oh, it feels so me. What do we mean by that? Why is one thing feeling more like me than something else? You know, like, what is this authenticity that we are searching for in fashion? And I think in the end, like, what I found really helpful was this idea of person and persona, and how something that a sociologist called Irving Goffman used. You know, he talked about social life as having a front and a backstage, but instead of saying that the front stage is where we appear and the backstage is where we are authentic or real, he meant that both front and backstage we perform. And I found that really interesting when you talk, you know, when talking about fashion, that it's not like one thing is more authentic than another, or, you know, that a consumer is more real wearing, I don't know, a white T-shirt and plain jeans rather than, you know, the Rihanna papal outfit. But it's, you know, all the time in social life, we perform to different extents. Even when we're at home by ourselves, we perform, because we're all socialized beings, right? So I think with fashion, I found this way of looking at it really interesting, and the kind of alternative to the idea that fashion is only is either only a veneer or something that we apply to our surface to manipulate our surroundings, or something, you know, this truly real, authentic, you know, non-fashion relationship that some people claim to have to garments, you know, where you just throw the closest thing on or whatever is crumpled up on your chair, and that's supposed to be a more authentic relation to appearance or to clothing. In my view, or if I came to any conclusion, is that it's all performative, all of it. You know, there's no way that that we can be a person in the world today, you know, even if we were naked, we would, you know, the way we appear in the world would still be performative. You know, our body language, the way, you know, the way we carry ourselves, the way we speak, the way we have our hair, you know, how we, I mean, all of it. It's that is a society. I mean, that's culture.
We'll be right back in just a bit to continue this conversation about fashion and the garment industry here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. All night tonight, we have been talking about fashion and the garment industry and many, many facets of it and different issues that it brings up. And we're joined now by award-winning journalist, comics anthologist, and cultural critic Anne Elizabeth Moore. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thanks for having me, Amy.
So in particular, I want to look at your book, Threadbare, which I highly recommend. If anyone does not have a copy of it, I recommend that they go find a copy because it's really, really an excellent book. But it really takes on a lot of themes of gender and labor and means of production and draws very, very eye-opening connections between the garment trade, the sex trade, human trafficking, and really these very meaty topics. And as I said at the top of the program, a lot of times we think of fashion and clothing as being very surface and superficial, but you know, this is really a very large issue, and it's connected to so many major, you know, human rights issues. So I wonder, perhaps to start, could you tell us how this book even came about and how these issues got on your radar?
Sure. Well, I mean, the book comes out of 7 years of reporting on and investigations and, you know, goofing off with garment workers in the factories in Cambodia. We started spending time around 2007. And, you know, at first I was doing sort of what we could call straight reporting for a queer woman. That's sort of a weird thing to say. But, you know, written in text on the internet or in publications. Without pictures. And as I got more and more into how the garment industry, the various ways that it mirrors all other aspects of women's labor that are related to the garment trade, such as modeling, warehouse work, eventually the sex trade, it started to become clear to me that that didn't necessarily make the most sense to do in text only. And so the project became this massive, like, 5-year comics journalism project that resulted in Threadbare, which is a book with about 8 or 9 different contributors that sort of took me around the world for close to a decade.
Yeah.
Talking to everyone involved in the garment trade that I could find and everyone involved in the sex trade that would be willing to speak to me for a comics project.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's such an interesting facet of it. Just that we don't often see comics and journalism intersecting quite in this way. We think of them intersecting only in like the one standalone political cartoon. We don't think about, you know, this medium as being such a powerful journalism tool, but in fact, it absolutely is. And when you think of this project and take it in, by the end, and you're like, there's no way this could have, like, this wouldn't have been the same thing if it was just text.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I did try to write a version of it in text, and it just, there was no way to convey the complexity of it. It also felt weird to just be doing it on my own when this was a project that involved just literally thousands of women's voices around the globe. And I needed it to look like it was coming from different people's voices, which is why we have a multitude of contributors in the book. The problem looks in a very distinct way. The problem that garment workers face when they walk into the garment factories in Cambodia or China or India, it looks exactly like the problems that women face when they walk into the warehouses where they're stocking the same clothes, or that models face when they walk into a new shoot sometimes. Mm. And the only way to really mirror that was in images, was in comics.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that part too is really interesting, that issues, you don't think about maybe a model and a manufacturer having that much in common, but in the terms in which it is spelled out in the book, it suddenly is like, of course they do. Of course there's so much in common here. Of course there's so much, there are layers here about economic justice and patriarchy and oppression. Like, there's all these things that they might come about in different ways, but of course some of these same issues are hitting. And so interestingly.
Well, I mean, thank you for saying that, but it was pretty daunting. I mean, I guess the moment that all came together was I did an art show at the Museum of Contemporary Art, and I was doing this performance where I was taking apart a pair of jeans by hand. I was just like de-threading it, and I was doing this project, and I was thinking through this garment worker uprising that was happening just at that time in 2014. in Cambodia, or sorry, 2010 in Cambodia. And there was this series of protests that were happening, but also at the same time, factory workers started fainting in mass numbers in various factories around the country. And it was so weird. And so people would come into the art museum, and they would sit with me, and we would tear apart these jeans by hand, and we would talk about the new developments in this mass fainting phenomenon that was happening in Cambodia. And the reason, the moment that it occurred to me that these problems were being replicated everywhere along the production line of garments around the world, was when a bunch of workers came in from H&M just up the street, and they came and they sat with me, and we were talking about the mass faintings, and they were like, oh my gosh, that's so weird, because we all just fainted yesterday on the factory floor at H&M, putting out, of course, the same clothes that the workers in Cambodia had been manufacturing when they fainted in the first place. And so I started digging into it more and really looking at those moments where, like, your physical body is affected by your work in the garment trade. And I just saw millions of ways that these same things are happening all across the production line. So, for example, when women in Cambodia are being heavily surveilled and sort of aggressively sexually harassed, the same thing happens under the same physical conditions in the same way as happens in the Walmart warehouses where those same clothes are being stacked. And eventually what we can see is that, of course, this is one actual industry where all these things can be traced back to. The garment industry is deliberately keeping wages low. It's refusing to look at the sexual harassment problems that come out in every single aspect of the industry. And it is directly contributing to the worldwide oppression of women in a provable way. And that's where the whole thing just became really like, oh my God, how are we going to make this a picture for people?
Yeah, right there, taking apart jeans. Wow. The economic part of this is very interesting, too. Just by the sheer number of women employed by this global industry in so many different ways, from the person selling the clothes, the person modeling, person assembling the clothes, and the person manufacturing the textiles, like all these different, you know, the warehouse workers, there's a lot of women. And the point, gets raised there about wage justice and this being kind of this special place to perhaps make headway and level, wage parity and work that out in the idea being like, if it's solvable in the garment industry, it's solvable anywhere. But how realistic is that really when we're talking about just, you know, not fainting at work and have like working under reasonable conditions, like is the wage part of that kind of not necessarily the next most obvious thing to solve? Is that a little bit further down outside of just basic human rights stuff?
I mean, at this point, the wage issue is a basic human rights issue. Like we're having women that can't afford to buy meat that isn't rotten, right? They're literally needing to feed themselves poison in order to get through the workday. They're having to lock their kids up because they can't afford childcare. So these things are at their base a wage issue. And definitely when we look at the earnings of a company like Inditex, which is opening new stores, you know, at like almost every single day, definitely every single week, still, you know, after like they've been doing that for like 10 years, they have the money to pay a living wage to workers. That's, you know, every company that's looked at how living wage increases could work has sort of shown this. But even if they didn't want to do that, even if money and pay were off the table, there are 400 other things that could be done today, immediately, to improve the lives of the workers around the world who are who are performing the labor of the garment industry. And keep in mind that that is between 1/6 and 1/7 of the world's population that is doing this work. So when we talk about the wage gap, we're talking about something that the garment industry could end almost overnight if it just decided to sort of commit to pay equity. But again, even if they didn't, they could install child care centers. They could make sure the workers had access to health care. They could stop harassing their workers. Mm-hmm. They could stop raping them. They could make sure that all of the factories were kept up to OSHA standards and that they weren't going to collapse on their workers. And that's all just even within the garment industry. Once we start looking at how the industry then justifies its way through the world by creating the human trafficking problem, then we have, you know, a much bigger and more complex set of problems that could also be ended tomorrow. If the garment industry stopped feeling the need to defend its right to pay women not very much money by claiming that this larger evil of human trafficking was out there waiting for women, then we could actually be addressing the real problem there, which is poverty. And paying women enough money to survive is the only way to eliminate both the problems created by the human trafficking industry, in theory, and the garment industry.
Right, definitely. And when we are looking at, you know, we talk when we're talking about issues connected to the garment industry, you know, sweatshops and labor practices, that comes up. But one that comes up that you talk about in the book that I don't think it gets as much attention as it should, and I don't think it comes up enough, and I think is possibly very widely misunderstood, is the issue attached to secondhand clothing. Because I think the prevailing narrative is that secondhand is not taking resources. It's not her. It's in fact responsible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the whole secondhand industry. And, you know, I was a loser punk kid growing up in the streets of Chicago. Like, I lived thrifting. That is literally how I survived and still do, largely. And so when I got to that part in the book where I was like, oh, now obviously I'm going to look at the way that, you know, secondhand clothing fixes all of these problems created by the garment industry. No. In the world of thrifted clothing, we have a very complicated situation where, because most of these companies are actually not-for-profit, they have successfully been able to argue that they don't have to pay even a minimum wage to many of their workers. And so workers with disabilities or on certain kinds of assistance are being paid sometimes a quarter or less. The surveillance in such locations is extremely high under the argument that people who work in thrift stores are likely to be less scrupulous than, you know, regular workers somehow. I don't know what the argument really is. But also that since the clothes are cheaper, they're much more likely to just take them. And so they're also under all sorts of surveillance, which then, of course, because women are involved and men are usually managing, turns really quickly into sexual harassment and aggression. And there are a couple of different thrift entities that are actually in all sorts of trouble because in chains around the country, they're committing sexual harassment or there's been sexual abuse on the floor of the thrift store in such great numbers that there are class action lawsuits pending against them. And so the problems created for the labor force in the thrift industry are enormous. But then, of course, the fact that they don't necessarily even address the waste issues created by the garment industry in the first place, because only some of the clothes go back into the thrift industry, some are sent back to the countries sometimes where they were created in the first place, and others are just, you know, sent to the dumpster. We've created a false solution to this thing that actually, of course, in the end, ends up generating more problems for women workers. It's just crazy.
Right. And yet, I think the prevailing narrative is that it's almost responsible to, you know, it's ideal to go buy all your stuff secondhand and to, you know, I think people say that. And, you know, anecdotally, I think people say that very casually all the time of like, oh, I'm not buying anything new. I'm going to just thrift. And that's, I mean, I'm with you. I thrift all the time and buy many of my things secondhand. However, I think, you know, so much awareness is needed around that particular aspect because I do think there's a sense of responsibility or a false sense of responsibility that comes along with having bought something secondhand as opposed to new.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of that has to do with how in the U.S. we seem to feel like we need to purport to some ethical consumerism, like as if that's even possible, you know?
Yeah.
Like we need to make choices that are better than the worst choices that we could make when all of the choices in the garment industry are bad. And I say that as someone who, like, you know, it's cold out today. I'm not going to walk around naked, and I wouldn't even advocate that for that if it were warm out today. Like, I don't want to be left with no options, but to be ethical in the world of clothing is not going to happen. I mean, every aspect of it is tainted with some form of trouble, including, you know, workers who are not paid enough to pick the cotton in the first place, or the way that the industry is implementing things like 3D printing and disadvantaging women workers. So it is a mess for sure. And maybe part of the reason that it's not getting addressed is this compelling need to think about ourselves as ethical.
Mm. That's a really interesting point. And so, I mean, I agree. I think it seems so damaged and so complicated that it seems almost overwhelming and hopeless. So what, I mean, where would even, I don't want to say what is the least evil choice, but, you know, where do we begin collectively really making changes in this way that impact lives in a meaningful way and that really does start to eradicate some of these main, you know, these major issues that are in this industry?
Yeah, when I was on tour with Threadbare, you know, this is like the final question. Like, they won't let you leave the room until you answer this question. Like, but what do I do? Like, how can I deal with this? I'm really keyed up and frustrated, but how am I supposed to, you know, where can I put my energy toward this? And there are three things that I think are really, really important. And the first one is that garment work is disadvantaging women around the world everywhere. And so we need to find a way to protect and support women who are the most vulnerable. And in the United States right now, especially with SESTA and FOSTA, that means sex workers who are often put into situations that are extremely dangerous. Around the world, of course, the sex work industry is closely tied to the garment industry. And so in places where the garment industry is the only option, women who don't want to put up with the on-the-job sexual abuse or incredibly low wages are forced into the garment industry because there just aren't other options. Many, of course, choose it because it is simply preferable and enjoyable compared to working 10-hour days at a sewing machine. And that translates as well to the U.S. So finding a way to support local sex workers' rights is actually a really important part of making sure that change can happen in the garment industry down the line. The other way, of course, is to start, you know, finding and supporting politicians that actually care about labor rights and making sure that globally women are represented in a fair way in all negotiations, but particularly with garment workers. And the other is to disengage, I think, yourself from a notion of ethics and start thinking about what does feel right to you as a person. Is it important for you to know the people that make your clothes? And it's not going to be feasible for everyone to fly to Cambodia and hang out with garment workers, although if you get the chance, you have to. They're amazing. But that's the way that I navigate that world, right? So I have clothes from H&M that were made in Cambodia, and I have clothes from, like, individual designers that work, you know, in the hills of Austria, that sort of made all their own clothes from the animals and running around the front yard or whatever, picking their own cotton, because that's the way that feels right to me. And those are the clothes that I wear when I go out and I talk about this stuff in public. And that's the only way that I've found to actually get through any of this on my side. So, you know, if to you, making your own clothes is a really important stance, then take the time to do that. If knowing how the labor policies work at the thrift store that you prefer to go to is important, find out what they are. Go ask those workers what their lives are like. Figure out how much they make, and then do some research and figure out whether or not there are any pending sexual harassment policies against that location. And to see what you can do to support people in a more general way.
All very sage advice.
Thank you.
I feel like we could stay on with you for hours to talk about this. There's so much here and so much to unpack. But the book is called Threadbare. It is one of your many titles. I recommend them all, but definitely Threadbare for tonight's topic for sure. Thank you so much, Anne Elizabeth Moore, for being with us this evening.
Oh, Amy, it was a delight to talk to you.